So as a show of good faith to you about how much less nervous I am now than in the first service, I will stand 2 feet further from the piano. I was hugging the piano pretty good this morning. So that's it. Thank you. So as I begin this morning, I have to confess something, first of all. Having been involved with Unitarian Universalism, and lucky enough to have been involved with Foothills, but only for four, maybe we could fudge it and call it 5 months now, when Gretchen asked me to do this, I thought, okay, that's great. And then I thought, oh. And I realized that I had more prejudices regarding UU hymns and singing and what I thought I knew about UU hymns and singing than I had actual information. And so it seemed to me that this was a great chance to maybe evaluate what I thought and reconsider some things and see if I could come to any sort of enlightenment. Hint, stay for the next 10 minutes. I did. So there's a good message here at the end. So it's a funny thing. When I discuss music with my friends who are church musicians, now that I'm at a UU church, the first thing they say is, they lean in and whisper almost as if it's a dirty secret, but you changed the words. And, yeah, so, but you changed the words. And admittedly, if we do, and if I'm, why I'm admitting things, 6 months ago, I would have been the person that leaned in and said, but you changed the words, as if this was the most unfathomable thing in the world. It's a funny thing, this idea that we criticize poets, musicians, or composers for changing the words to a hymn, to something that already existed, in a form that we thought was unchangeable. As a music-loving people, we so often imbue the same sense of untouchable holy piety on the text of our most beloved hymns that we would with a treatment of a Mozart opera. Full disclaimer, you should not change the words to a Mozart opera. I am not condoning that in any way, shape, or form. So I feel like so often we, and I include myself in this, but not so much you all, for reasons we'll get to, we sort of march forth carrying ye old flag of tradition, ready to bravely vanquish the dangerous and heretical new texts which threaten the very essence and being of our untouchable hymnody. So as I've been reevaluating my prejudices towards the subject, I've begun to become more aware of the result of this sort of thinking. In so many of the churches and traditions that I've worked in, we sing these traditional and often untouchable hymn tunes. We revere them so much that we sing them as if they were enshrined in a glass container filled with gas to ensure that they were preserved and never sullied or dirtied by the world around them. We are so attached to them, in fact, that I dare say at times we sing them as if we are entirely unattached to them. Now, I grant you, with many of these stalwart hymns, many congregants could sing them at 3 a.m. with the flu, in the dark, with laryngitis. But I propose to you, it's not just a product of rote memorization that causes this sort of sense of detachment. I would suggest to you that our corporate refusal to routinely examine the texts we sing and to modify them according to their most effective use within our worship forces us to detach from the meaning, because we are necessarily misaligning our texts of our songs with our beliefs and our purpose. So now let me pause and say, well, intellectually, that sounds super. Like, good for me for saying that. I do love the old hymns and the old tradition. And so I admit that as I say that, I'm a big fan of the traditions. But now, having sufficiently maligned my history of singing and the history of singing of perhaps a billion people in the world, this is the part where I tell you why Unitarian Universalists have gotten it so right by actively getting it so wrong. So Jason Shelton, who I'm sure many, if not all of you, are familiar with, and someone who I am quickly becoming familiar with, wrote an excellent article entitled "Changing the Words: An Historical Introduction to Unitarian Universal Hymnody." You know it's a good article because it has a colon in the title. And also, I recommend, if you want to go home and do a quick Google search, it's a short paper, it's about 12 pages, and it's just really fascinating, examining the history of UU hymnody. The title of this paper, I believe, gives away the punchline to the message in the title itself. In evaluating the history of UU hymnody, it seems to me that it's unlikely that you're going to walk away thinking, oh my goodness, let's talk about the theory or the compositional structure of these hymns. Or even, surprisingly, I think it's less likely that you'll say, I'm really just blown away by the stylistic variety of these hymns. No, when you look at the UU hymnody, the overarching factor that you walk away with is changing the words. There was one statistic, I didn't share this with the first service, but you're laughing at me more, laughing at my jokes more. And thank you. There was a period of about 50 years in the mid-1800s in which other mainline denominations changed their hymnal zero times or perhaps one time. The Unitarian Universalist, bless them, they changed their hymnal 53 times in that time. Jason Shelton highlights this quite clearly in the opening of his paper, stating, "It is my contention that a hymn book represents the theological and ecclesial self-understanding of a religion at a particular moment in history." He then adds, "The call for a new hymn book almost always comes from a sense of the current tome being out of date." Now, if you've grown up in the UU Church, or perhaps have just been lucky enough to be a part of Foothills for a handful of years, it's entirely possible that at some point you become so used to the wonderful things that happen here that you grow, or you take a little bit for granted, the uniqueness and specialness of being in a place that calls for, quote, "a free and responsible search for truth and meaning as one of its core principles." This beautiful gift of intellectual freedom and inclusive corporate purpose means that we are actively engaged with the text, with the meaning, and with the spirit of these hymns. And accordingly, we refuse to let them fade out of relevance, only to be enshrined into the sterile container of history. Shortly after I began at Foothills, I was confronted with perhaps the most cliche of Unitarian Universalist musician problems. And I use scare quotes on the word problem in my script here. And the problem, such as it was that after singing a song, rehearsing a choir anthem, it was suggested to me afterwards that perhaps all of the texts of the anthem weren't ideal, maybe didn't line up with our mission perfectly, and perhaps we could consider changing them. Gasp. So standing before you now, as I'm being recorded to put on the internet, and I can't afford to pay the editor to change this, with Gretchen, my supervisor, standing in the room, I freely admit to you now, my initial reaction to the suggestion was frustration and annoyance. In my last decade of church work, the closest thing I've ever had to a liturgical whoopsie was when I tried to program a Christmas song during Advent. And I'm still coming to terms with why that doesn't work. But so later that night, I sat home reflecting, as I've done many times since then, and especially in the last few weeks as I was preparing this. And I was frustrated by how stymied I felt, because I was so limited in what I could say. And then it hit me. What is limiting is that God is always a man in our songs. What is limiting is that all references to God or Jesus or any power or any other thing have to be gendered in the first place. What is limiting is using old forms of English, which are so archaic that they aren't even relevant to the way we understand or communicate today. What is limiting is not being able to read what I'm doing. What is limiting is using language so exclusive that you have to shut off the compassionate and intellectual part of your mind just to avoid the inevitable cognitive dissonance that singing those lyrics will inevitably cause. That I was asked to consider changing the words to a choir anthem is not limiting. If anything, it is breaking down the limits and inviting everyone in. Inviting everyone in to actively engage, inviting everyone in so that they, in turn, can invite everyone else in. So, this is the job security part of this, where I redeem myself. So the next time someone approaches me after choir, or after service, or sends me a pleasantly worded email, because we always prefer those, instead of being frustrated or annoyed, my reaction, I hope, will be thank you. Thank you for being so engaged in your free and responsible search for truth and meaning that you hear and critically evaluate the words that you are singing and what they mean. Thank you for being actively inclusive. If music is the international language, then thank you for helping us to ensure that we use this language, or this international language, to actively welcome in to this community as we share love around the world. So before I launch into this last part, I thought I would share with you the things that you missed out on that I was going to talk about that I decided. And perhaps that will make you grateful that I didn't go there after all. As I was trying to think about you hymnody, what does this mean to me? I got hung up on a couple of things, and at one point I had, and I'm not kidding you, a full 20 minutes prepared on why Spirit of Life ends on an E natural and not a and not a C natural, as it should. So, but I convinced myself that there is a sort of theological reason that this is the case. I also thought about exploring why we sing such willfully difficult music like Fire of Commitment and the way we could relate that to the seven principles. And I couldn't do it without slides and without you taking notes. And so in an effort to make your life more difficult, I thought I would delve into a much more difficult topic, but one that is perhaps much more pertinent to what we do here. So as I bragged on us earlier for being so open and inclusive in our language, this search for inclusivity inevitably leads us into the murky waters of cultural appropriation. Not that we consciously intend to cause any such appropriation, of course, but it is the necessary outcome of a predominantly white group of people singing the songs of minorities, and in particular with spirituals, the songs of oppressed minorities. And so I think it is a point worth examining to sort of look at the history of two songs that we sang in the service already. You might remember the irony of the first song we sang, When the Summer Sun is Shining, which sounded wonderful when I chose it. And that which is, if you're not familiar, does anybody know that tune? Bum ba da dum bum bum ba da 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 dum. Okay, a few people. Okay. Every time I do this, I argue with Gretchen, people will know these tunes. These are standard tunes with just new words, and she says, no, they won't. And she was right. I have twice been proven that now, so I rest. So that is a rewritten verse on a really famous Northeastern hymn tune. This was written in the early 1800s for a songbook called Southern Harmony, and it was in that school of shape note singing. If you've never seen shape note singing, it is worth like a quick Google image search, because what you have, interestingly, it's the idea to make it easier to read and to sort of like train you if you don't read music. Every different line on the staff is assigned a note. So like an E natural might be a diamond, and an F might be a square, and a G might be a circle. And so it's really interesting, unless you read music, and then it's terrible. And it will utterly destroy your ability to read any music whatsoever. So we have this hymn tune, for which we have changed the words, of course, written by privileged white Christians in their newly built country, which they created explicitly to allow their own free religious expression. Adding to that, they were even musically influenced by some of the greatest German and English church music traditions. So this is quite a litany of privilege and education that led to this, the writing of this hymn. This hymn tune, which found its birth in the New World, and all of the freedom that history teaches us that that should entail, was so heavily ensconced in Eurocentric traditions that it barely manages to break free from the basic constraints of a diatonic setting in 4/4 meter. Which, for those of you who didn't take music theory, I just said it's a little bit uptight, and it's kind of boring. Only a little bit, though. It is a good melody, but it's a bit uptight. So now let's contrast that with the song that immediately followed it that I'm pretty sure we all knew, Wade in the Water. If the summer sun is shining, which it's not, seems a little bit predictable in its musical setting, there is something incredibly catchy and even downright exciting about the tune to Wade in the Water. In fact, I'm going to wager that there's a good chance that some of you will be humming it as you go home today, and you might even lay in bed tonight humming it, hopefully in your head, so you don't bother anybody else. But for all of Wade in the Water's charm, there is a danger here. What does it say, or what does it seem to suggest, if we, as a privileged white, predominantly white community, merrily sing this song, humming it under our breath all day long as we go to brunch, and we go to the park, and we play frisbee golf, all the things that I planned before this happened. So I suppose as we sit inside and watch Netflix, might be more appropriate today. So what does it say, though, if we hum that song under our breath as we go along our day, enjoying the beautiful weather, even if it is raining? without giving the song its due weight or honoring its true voice. Whereas when the summer sun is shining, the hymn is a reflection of white privilege in a way. It was created in a country that owed a large part of its wealth and success early on to slavery. Wade in the Water exists as a sad and heartfelt testament to that unbearable injustice. Now, while the text of Wade in the Water draws much inspiration from the Old Testament, it is widely believed that the song was born out of the time of slavery. The text was intended both as inspirational, but also explicitly instructional to slaves fleeing to the north. The instructions, "Wade in the water," literally meant "wade in the water." As you are fleeing north, the idea was to disguise your scent from the slave master's dogs, you should get in the water and travel, because then they can't pick up your scent. For these reasons, "Wade in the Water" is most closely associated with the Underground Railroad and is often thought of as a song that was promoted by Harriet Tubman. So I explain this history for a simple reason. I'm in no way suggesting that we should abandon the singing of these songs out of fear that our intentions could be misconstrued or offensive. Rather, I believe that the direction of Unitarian Universalist music, that we should make our experience as diverse as possible, is a noble one, and one that should absolutely be pursued. However, it is important, if for no other reason than to educate ourselves, that we stop and take a moment to examine our history and the circumstances out of which these spirituals came. If we glibly sing spirituals and think to ourselves, what fun these catchy tunes are, then we are turning a blind eye to the pain that was inflicted on a large, enormous group of people that bore out these songs, and the voice which cries out from within these spirituals. It is our duty to honor them, the birth and heritage of these songs, to give voice to them, and to ensure that their legacy does not die out. Now, if you go to our church Facebook page, and I hope that you do, and I hope that you like it, hopefully you'll notice our cover photo. It's hard to miss. It makes a statement, to be for sure. It says, on the second line, "Black Lives Matter." Now, we do not question that we say, together in support, "Black Lives Matter." Rather, we offer up our voices in unison with all of our fellow people of all races. We understand the lack of our own understanding, that while we try our best to be empathetic and we voice our concerns of the movement, if we have lived a life in the United States as a white person, we can never fully understand just how much we don't understand. Yet we accept this and we offer our voices in solidarity nevertheless. It is in this same way that I propose that we encounter and experience the spirituals that have become a beloved part of our tradition. We know that we did not create them, and we must accept that we cannot fully give voice to the pain and the incredible injustice which gave birth to them. However, they do speak to our movement, and we are proud to give voice to them, that they may continue to cast influence and remind us of the past, long into the future. Perhaps the most respectful thing that we can do when singing spirituals is to sing them proudly and to give them all of the voice and spirit that we have to offer so that their message and our spirit of love becomes unavoidably infectious, bringing us together and positively affecting all of our communities.